All right, let's take our Bibles and go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Yes, I should announce that. Dottie's back with us again. She's been out quite a while after having had back surgery, and she's going to try to stay as long as she can. But if she gets up and leaves, it's because, you know,
it's not me.
It's just it's difficult to sit for long periods of time. So,
I'd like to thank everybody for their prayers and their cards and well wishes. I mean, it means a lot. Believe me, prayer really helps.
Sure does.
Sure.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
We have to remember to pray for one another because, you know, we're living in a cursed world. We have a body that's decaying. It's under the curse. And all of us feel the effects of it. And as we get older, it becomes more and more. Right, Marge?
Right.
You know, it's very difficult for Marge to get here. You know, but she does. Even though it's painful and all that, she comes. And we need to pray for one another. Lift one another up. Along those lines, I probably should announce now that Carl's wife, her granddaughter's husband was killed a few days ago in Michigan, and they're kind of grieving over that, so keep them in your prayers as well. And he leaves behind a wife and children, small children. So anyway, keep them in your prayers. Carl won't be here this morning. So all right, let's get into 1 Corinthians 9. We got through, I think, the first two verses last week. I think we'll move a little quicker this time. But let me go ahead and start again in verse 1 so we get the context. Am I not an apostle? Am I not free? Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If I am not an apostle to others, yet doubtless I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. We briefly talked about last week the fact that Paul's apostleship was being challenged. The fact that he was indeed an apostle of Christ as one who was proclaiming the words of Christ as an eyewitness to the resurrection. His position as Christ's ambassador was being challenged. It was being challenged by those who had a Greek philosophical mindset. And this Greek philosophy had permeated this church quite a bit. And we'll see a lot of it when we get into chapter 15 and how it had actually reached the point where many in the church were actually denying the idea that the body would be resurrected. And this came from Greek philosophy and so forth. So his apostleship was being challenged. Now, in some of the other churches, Paul had a big problem here because he was being challenged on two fronts. He was being challenged by the philosophically minded Greek Christians, and he was being challenged by the Jews who were saying that Paul's teaching some foreign gospel because he doesn't require the Gentiles to keep the law. And so he had it from both ends, from both the Jews and the Greeks. And he constantly had to defend himself. We'll see it here in 1 Corinthians. It occurs again in 2 Corinthians. The whole book of Galatians is a defense of Paul's apostleship and the message that he preached against the Jews who were doing essentially the same thing. All right, so he says, if I am not an apostle to others, yet doubtless I am to you. In other words, look, even if other people don't consider me an apostle, you all ought to consider me an apostle of Christ. And he says, because you are my seal. You are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. And last week I talked a little bit about the fact that through the apostles' hands they had received spiritual gifts. All right, so that in itself testified to Paul's apostleship. He had the signs of an apostle, as it says in 2 Corinthians. So he says in verse 3, my defense to those who examine me is this. Now, those who examine him are people in the Corinthian church who were challenging him. They were looking at his life, looking at his ministry, looking at how he proclaimed the gospel, how he worked, and challenged him. Now, that's really a sad state of affairs, isn't it? Here you have an apostle of Christ being openly challenged within the church, but that's how wonderful this church was. All right, so he says, do we not have the right to eat and drink? Do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do also the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord, and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working? Now, by the way, Barnabas and I, he's talking about when Paul came through Corinth and preached the gospel the first time on his missionary journey, he was paired up with Barnabas. All right, so Paul and Barnabas were there, and so he's, because they had seen Paul and Barnabas and he had preached, they both had been there working, he asked this question: is it only I and Barnabas who have no right to refrain from working? Now, what does he mean by refrain from working? What does he mean? What is he driving at here? We need to deduce what the question was or the problem was from Paul's answer. So he's asking, is it only me and Barnabas that have no right to refrain from working? What does he mean? Anybody want to take a stab at that?
When they let him work?
No, he's talking about refraining from working. He was working. Yes, George?
He's saying, am I the only, Barnabas and I the only ones that have to work to make a living? The other apostles are supported by the churches.
Paul's practice, which we'll see as we go through this chapter, Paul's practice was that when he went into a town to preach the gospel, he would find a job. And he would find employment, and he would provide for himself, and he would preach. He would start a church. He would teach in that church, but he wouldn't take money from that church as support. That was his practice. All right? But that was not the practice of the other apostles. The other apostles, when they would go from place to place and they would preach, they would be supported by the churches. And so here's Paul, and this church knew that. They knew that the other apostles were being supported by the churches. And here comes Paul, and he is working a job with his hands, and he's not taking support. And they actually, instead of looking up to him for that, because he was doing that voluntarily, they looked down on him, thinking, well, he must not be fully qualified, or he must not be on the par of the other apostles, because the other apostles are being supported by the churches, and Paul's not. All right, it's stupid. It sounds ridiculous. And Paul goes on in this chapter, as we'll see a little further, to explain why he does it this way. All right, so he says, but essentially what he's defending here is the right. First, he defends the right for the preachers of the gospel to be supported by the churches. He defends that right first, and then he later goes in and defends why he doesn't do it that way himself. Okay, and so essentially he's holding himself even to a higher standard than what Christ has commanded. So he says, do we have no right to eat and drink, verse 4. And when he says eat and drink, he means to receive from the church food, drink, clothing, the necessities of life. Okay? He says, do we have no right for these things? Do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do also the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas, which is Peter? So he says, the other apostles, you know who they are, they're the other 11, and the brothers of the Lord. And by this time, Jesus' natural brothers, some of them at least, had become converts and were preaching the gospel. James being one of them, who was now at this time the leader of the church in Jerusalem. All right, and then he names Peter specifically because Peter was the first of the apostles in priority. Yes.
That's the way it was at the farm, that church that you've seen the picture of drawing. We didn't have a full-time pastor.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was a kid. I just knew what was going on. So they come, mostly as I know, they volunteer because they didn't get maybe a dollar or two in the collection.
Mm-hmm.
So they go home with them, give them meal and all that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. All right, so he's now, what does he mean by do we have no right to take along a believing wife? What does he mean by that? Does anybody know? In this context, in the context of being supported by the church, the people to whom he was ministering should be supporting him, or at least they were the other apostles. And he says, we also, or don't we also have the right to take along a believing wife? What do you think he means by that? Is he saying we have a right, I have a right to have a wife? That's not what he said. He said to take along a believing wife. What does he mean by that? Think about that.
To assist him, they pay for her expenses.
There you go. What essentially he's saying is, don't we have the right, first of all, number one, to be supported by the work of the ministry? Okay? Don't we also have the right to bring along our wife? In other words, for our family to be supported as well, not just the person speaking. Okay? That's essentially what he's saying. All right, and this will become clearer as we go through the passage. You'll see that that's exactly what he means. You don't have to believe me just based on this verse, but as we go through the rest of these verses, he explains it more fully and you'll understand. All right, so then he says, by the way, in verse 6, or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working? Refrain from working here means refrain from secular employment, okay, as I think George said earlier, from having to hold a separate job so that he could then, because then he's got to spend all his time on his job instead of preaching and you know, ministering to the saints. All right, so he says, verse 7, and now remember, he's arguing for the privilege of ministers of the gospel to be supported by the people to whom they minister. He's arguing for that principle here. He says, whoever goes to war at his own expense? It's a rhetorical question. You know, you don't take a soldier and send him into battle and say, you have to buy your gun, you have to buy your uniforms, you have to buy the ammo, and you have to go get a job to pay for your own food and all that. What do they do when they go to war, right? The government that's sending them provides everything they need to go to war, and that's essentially what his comment is, all right? So who goes to war at his own expense? Or who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit? A farmer who does all the work to cultivate his crops, doesn't he get the reward of the crops? And of course, the answer is, of course he does, right? So he says, who tends a flock and does not drink the milk of the flock? Again, these are just three different examples, and they all show the same thing. Verse 8, do I say these things as a mere man, or does not the law say the same also? Now, what he's doing, first he appeals to just simple logic, right? It's simply logical that a soldier, the things he needs to live are provided for by the people he's serving, all right? It's simply logical. So he appeals to logic. Now he's going to appeal to the Old Testament to support the very same principles. All right, so he says, does not the law say the same also? For it is written, verse 9, in the law of Moses, quote, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Now, what does that mean? Somebody tell me. What does it mean you don't muzzle the ox? Yeah.
I think it means to allow the ox to eat while it works,
basically. Sure. Yeah. He's harvesting a field. He's pulling along a cart or whatever it is. And shouldn't he be allowed to eat from the field that he's serving in? Of course. Okay, it makes common sense. And the law of Moses says that. But then he says, is it oxen God is concerned about? So what is he saying there? Essentially, he's saying God put this principle in the law that when you're harvesting, you don't muzzle your ox. You let him eat. Okay? God put that principle in there not because he's concerned about your ox. What is he concerned about? He's concerned about teaching a principle to his people that those who are working in his field should be fed by his field. Okay? It's a principle. Did you have your hand up, Walter, or are you just scratching? Okay. All right, so he goes on. Verse 10. Or does he say it altogether for our sakes? And notice he didn't say, did he say it altogether for the sakes of the people in the Old Testament? You see that? He says he said it for our sakes. He told the Jews not to muzzle their ox for our sake. Okay? In other words, what he's essentially doing is he's taking a principle that was taught symbolically in the Old Testament, and he's saying that principle, he put that there not only for them, but for us. Okay? So we could learn something from it as well. All right. And why? He said that, or so that, he who plows should plow in hope. And when he uses the word plow, he's using it as a metaphor for a preacher of the gospel. Okay? So that he's not going to starve while he's trying to preach the gospel and so forth. He can do it knowing that his finances and his needs are being taken care of. And that he who threshes in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we, and Paul here is referring to himself, Barnabas, Apollos who came later, other ministers of the gospel, those who are working to build up this church. He says, if we have sown spiritual things. So, the word sown, you know, that's a farming word, right? Mm-hmm. To sow. It means to plant. All right. Scattering the seed. If we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? In other words, if we're preaching the gospel, if we're teaching you, in another place the Bible says those who are taught in the word should communicate or support those who teach. All right? This, it's the same principle that's being taught. And it's the reason why ministers are paid for their work as a salary. Now, the Apostle Paul didn't use that, and we'll get to his reasons later. All right. Verse 12. If others are partakers of this right over you, and that makes it very clear that this church was, in fact, supporting others, but not Paul. And yet he's the one who started the church. All right, so he says, if others are partakers of this right over you, are not we even more? Or in other words, shouldn't we be sort of first on the list because we're the ones who started the church? We're the ones who put in all the work to get this church going. He says, nevertheless, we have not used this right. And I want you to notice that he uses the word right. You see that? This right. What is a right? What is a right? When someone says, I have right, I have the right to, for something. What is it? What do they mean?
You have control.
You have legitimate claim to something.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. You have a legitimate claim for whatever it is that we're speaking about. So he says, nevertheless, we, meaning him and Barnabas, have not used this right, but endure all things, lest we should hinder the gospel. And now he begins to explain his reason why he took a job to support himself and did not take money from this church. Yes, George.
Yeah, I see chapter 8, you know, where he's making a point, but then he elaborates. Now that he's on the subject, he elaborates. But there's a connection between chapter 7, chapter 8, 9, and 10, where in chapter 7 he lays down a principle in verse. He talks about using the not to abuse the liberty.
Well, just tell us, George. You don't have to find it.
The point is in chapter eight, the discussion is offending a weaker brother by eating meat. Okay, and so then the point he makes is not to use your don't let your liberty be the occasion of a stumbling block of a brother. Mm-hmm. Then he goes in chapter 8, he says, look, and then he uses himself and Barnabas as an example. He says, look, aren't we apostles? Don't we deserve the same treatment that other apostles are getting? Shouldn't we? And then he uses the example of the ox and the guy, the one with the shepherd with the sheep and then getting the milk, and later on he goes into the priests in the temple, how they're paid from the services. And then, but his whole point is, look, we have this right, and we can demand this of you, but yet we take advantage, because it's tied to chapter 7. We abstain, self-sacrifice. In order for the sake of the gospel, although we have this liberty and this authority, for the sake of the gospel, we don't take advantage of it. In the same way, you with a weaker brother, although you have this right, And although, yes, you can participate in these meals and eat meat that is offered to idols, in the same way, you should refrain from it. You should...
He's setting an example
exactly right.
of going above and beyond
right.
What you're called to do.
That's the how it ties in with chapter 7.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, chapter 8, you say, look what we do for the sake of the gospel. Shouldn't you do the same thing for the sake of the weaker brother?
Yes.
I think it also makes the point that he's doing it completely voluntarily, like he doesn't feel compelled to
yes.
do it because they're feeding him or something.
Yeah.
So it makes the point that he's there because that's his desire.
Yes. In fact, he later, several verses later, he actually says that. That's exactly right. He makes a point of saying, I'm doing this voluntarily. And he makes a point of saying, though, that it is a right of ministers of the gospel. Okay? All right. So, and also, remember, the other apostles were using this right. Okay? Peter and James and all the others were being supported by the churches that they ministered to. So he's certainly not condemning them, is he? He's not condemning them at all. He's just saying, I'm going above and beyond even what the Lord has commanded. All right? By sacrificing myself. Yes.
Is he afraid that if he demanded the right, that they would be, that people would be less interested in the message?
Yeah. Yeah, he was. Now, also keep in mind, the other apostles, for the most part, were not really focusing on the Gentiles, the pagans, the way Paul was. All right, Paul had a unique ministry to go out to the people who were the farthest away from Judaism and familiarity with the Jewish faith. All right, he went to those people. And you remember when Jesus sent his disciples out the first time? In fact, I'm going to be talking about this in my sermon. When Jesus sent his disciples out in Matthew chapter 10 to preach to the Jews, you know, he did that before he sent them out into all the world. Right? He told them not to bring anything with them. He said, don't bring any money. Don't bring any supplies, nothing. When you go and preach, because you're preaching to your brothers, the Jews, right? They are to support you. He said, you find a home where they are worthy, and you stay with them, and you let them support you during your time of ministry there. And then, if they receive you and they support you, he says, they have received me. If they don't, if they refuse, then he says, they have refused me. All right, but why? He's sending them to their brothers, to the Jewish people. But now Paul, Christ sent Paul out to these foreigners, to these people who were absolutely opposed to the whole message of the gospel. And so Paul took it upon himself to say, you know what? I have a right to do that, but I'm not going to. Why? Because he doesn't want to hinder the message. All right, as it's breaking new ground. Now, once people are trained and they understand the message and they become believers and all that, the Apostle Paul did later take support, especially from the church in Philippi. In fact, at one point, he says that they had supplied all of his needs, this one church. All right, while he was in prison, and they were paying. In fact, Acts ends with Paul in prison in Rome, but he's not in a jail cell. He was under Roman guard, but he had a hired house. He had a rented house with guards being paid stationed to keep him so that he wouldn't have to be in a prison cell. Why? So that he could minister. He was holding church in his jailhouse that he was renting. And you know who was paying the bill? The church in Philippi. They were paying the bill. All right? That's pretty amazing. So don't get the idea that Paul always refused support. He did when he went into a new area to establish a church and so forth, especially amongst the pagans. All right, let's move along to verse 13. This is a very important verse. He says, do you not know that those who minister the holy things eat of the things of the temple, and those who serve at the altar partake of the offerings of the altar? Verse 14, very important word. The very first word, it says, even so, or two words, even so. It's one Greek word, it's an adverb, and it simply means after this pattern, or in this manner. So he says, even so, or after this pattern, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. Now, after what manner? He's talking about a pattern, and we need to look at that pattern. if we're really going to understand how the church and its ministry is supposed to be supported. So let's go back to where that pattern is talked about, and it's in Numbers chapter 18. Is anyone warm? I'm kind of warm. I don't know how you guys are doing. Yeah? Yeah?
I got it, George.
You're okay. Well, you will be in a minute. Numbers chapter 18. If Christ commanded that the church follow the same pattern, we ought to know what the pattern is. All right, let's go to verse 8. You all know what a tithe is, right? Everybody know what a tithe was? Tithe was the children of Israel were commanded to keep to bring 10%. Of what's called their increase. That's their profit. That's their net income, not gross income. It's their net income. It's what they have increased through the year. And it was usually done in crops because they were farmers. So they were to bring 10% to the Lord's house. And the tribe of Levi, how many tribes did Israel have?
12.
How many tribes paid tithes?
11.
No, 12. Gotcha. The tribe of Levi also paid the tithe. But here's the way it worked. You've got 12 tribes. The tribe of Levi did not receive a land inheritance to farm. The others did. The tribe of Levi, they had a place to live, but they didn't have land to farm. But they worked at the temple and ministered in all the things of God. And so God told the other 11 tribes to bring 10%. When they came up to Jerusalem to worship, to bring 10% to the house of God and to give it to the tribe of Levi, the Levites, who are the priests at the temple. All right. But the tribe of Levi then had to take 10% of what was given to them and give it to God, to the temple, to support the temple itself. Okay. So that's how it went. Let's read it. Verse 8. Numbers 18, verse 8. The Lord spoke to Aaron. Here, I myself have also given you charge of my heave offerings. By the way, Aaron was Moses' brother of the tribe of Levi, and the elite priests, if you will, were Aaron and his sons. Okay? All the holy gifts of the children of Israel, I have given them as a portion to you and your sons as an ordinance forever. This shall be yours of the most holy things reserved from the fire, every offering of theirs, that is all the other tribes, every grain offering, every sin offering, every trespass offering, which they render to me shall be most holy for you and your sons. Now the offerings, you know, they would bring an animal. They brought grain, they brought money, they brought lots of things to God as an offering, as a gift. But they also brought sacrifices, animal sacrifices, right? And so of the sacrifices, the meat, after the animal was killed, the meat, they were slaughtered and the meat was cut up and used for food. All right? The priests were to receive these offerings. So he says, verse 10, in a most holy place you shall eat it. Every male shall eat it. It shall be holy to you. This also is yours, the heave offering of their gift. And heave offering is, what does the word heave mean? Well, no, not that. That's not what it's talking about. What do we say when we heave something? It means you lift it, right? You lift. Well, it's because they brought all this stuff to the temple. Okay? They had unloaded. They brought carts. When they came up, they had their wagons pulled by their animals and so forth with all their gifts of grain and crops and all the things that that they were bringing to the temple. And they had big storehouses, big warehouse-type places, for this stuff to be stored and to be used to support the priest. Yes?
I've seen the witness of this one way. When I was in Belgium, the dog hauled a cart to the place where I can't think of everything, but where they sell stuff, people come and buy. Mm-hmm. And there's dogs around everywhere. And then when you walk by, they're all barking at you.
Mm-hmm.
But
dogs with carts, huh?
I've seen that.
Right. I guess if dogs can pull sleds in Alaska, they can.
I've seen this big horse. Paul must be 8 feet tall, haul a wagon as long as here, the wall, stacked up with carcass of beef going down the street.
I guess. You can wash that off, though. All right, verse 11. This also is yours, the heave offering of their gifts, with all the wave offerings of the children of Israel. I have given them to you and your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. Everyone who is clean in your house may eat it. And all the best of the oil and all the best of the new wine and the grain, their first fruits, which they offer to the Lord, I have given them to you. In other words, all the stuff that the people were bringing to God, they were to bring their best, by the way, right? When they brought their animal sacrifices, they were to be the best. When they brought their grain, it was to be the best, all right? The 10% best that God had blessed them in their endeavors, they were to bring for the support of God's house and his ministers. All right, so he says, verse 13, whatever first ripe fruit is in their hand, which they bring to the Lord, shall be yours. Everyone who is clean in your house may eat it, and so forth. Now let's skip down to verse 21. Behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work which they perform, the work of the tabernacle of meeting. Hereafter, the children of Israel shall not come near the tabernacle of meeting, lest they bear their sin and die. But I'm in verse 22 now. Now verse 23, Numbers 18, 23. But the Levites shall perform the work of the tabernacle of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations that among the children of Israel they shall have no inheritance. That means they didn't have land to farm. Okay? Instead, they were supported by the people. For the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer up as a heave offering to the Lord, I have given to the Levites as an inheritance. Therefore, I have said to them, among the children of Israel, they shall have no inheritance. Verse 25, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak thus to the Levites, that is the ministers, the priests, and say to them, when you take from the children of Israel the tithes which I have given you from them as your inheritance, then you shall offer up a heave offering of it to the Lord, a tenth of the tithe. So look, the Levites were not exempt from tithing. All right? When they received from the people the tithe, they then had to turn around and take 10% of that and give it back to God. All right? So ministers are not exempt from tithing, just like you are not. Okay. Verse 27. And your heave offerings shall be reckoned to you as though it were the grain of the threshing floor, and so forth. I'm not going to read the rest of this. You get the general idea. All right, you can read the whole chapter if you want at home, but you get the general idea. Okay, 10% of the people's income went to the priesthood, the ministers. Then 10% of that went to the house of God to maintain the temple of God and so forth. All right, so that's essentially how it was set up. The same practice continued once the temple was built. This was during the time of the tabernacle in the wilderness, but the same principles continued on and so forth. So let's get back to what the Apostle Paul is saying here and how he's tying all this together back in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Let me read verse 13 again. Do you not know that those who minister the holy things eat of the things of the temple? And, of course, he's referring to Numbers 18 that we just read. And, of course, they knew that, and now you all know that, right? So he says, and those who serve at the altar partake of the offerings of the altar. Even so, or, that, like I said before, that word means after this pattern. Okay, after this pattern. It's an example. He is taking the previous example and saying this is how it's to be done now. But look what he also said. He said, even so, this is how you ought to do it. No, he said, even so, the Lord has commanded. And the Lord he's talking about is Christ. Now, tell me, where did Christ endorse this? Does anybody know? Where did Christ endorse the idea of using the Old Testament system of support for Christians? Where did Christ endorse that?
In the
It would have to be something Christ said.
Oh.
So it's going to have to come from the New Testament. Does anybody know? I'll tell you, it's in Matthew. It's in the Sermon on the Mount. Go to Matthew chapter 5.
Chapter what?
5. We're studying the commandments of Jesus, and actually it was in his first command. The first command begins in verse, and I labeled it when I was preaching on it, I labeled it, watch your mouth, okay, because it had to do with your interaction with your fellow brothers and sisters, and you're not to offend them, okay? And he said, you have heard it was said of old, you shall not murder. Whoever murders will be in danger of judgment. But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. And whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Now notice verse 23. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. What is he saying? Now, remember, in the context, the temple was still there. These disciples of Jesus were still worshiping at the temple at this time. But what was Jesus doing in this sermon? Was he telling them how the Jews should be worshiping? No, he's telling them, he's preparing them to send them out into all the world. Remember what he said in Matthew 28 when he sent them on the Great Commission? He said to go to all the world, preach the gospel, right? He said, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. All right, in other words, take all the things I've taught you now, and now you're to go out and teach them to all the other nations. And so Christ's commandments that we have in the Sermon on the Mount are intended. He was training those men there while they were still under the system of the temple worship. He was training them, though, for the future. He was training them to send them out and to preach the gospel and then to teach Christians. And then during that time, churches were organized and so forth. But why would Christ command them as Christians about bringing your gift to the altar and so forth if that was never going to be done anymore? Now, it's not brought to the Jewish temple anymore. But as you can see, the way Paul applies it, when we get back here to 1 Corinthians, Paul is essentially saying that the pattern that was established in the Old Testament is to be continued in the church. And that makes perfect sense with what Jesus commanded. All right? And I think that's what Paul was referring to when he said, even so the Lord commanded. All right, that's my opinion on that. You can, if you disagree, that's fine. Verse 15. We're back in 1 Corinthians 9, and we're almost out of time, but let's take another verse. But I have used none of these things. And remember, Paul called them a rite, and Paul said that the other apostles were using these things. Himself, he says, I have used none of these things, at least not with the Corinthians, he didn't. Nor have I written these things that it should be done so to me. In other words, what he's essentially saying is, I'm not defending this rite of ministers of the gospel to be supported by the church. I'm not defending it so that you will support me. All right? He's simply telling them, I'm not doing that. All right? And he apparently had no intention of taking any money or support from these people. For it would be better for me to die than anyone should make my boasting void. What does he mean by that? It sounds kind of, what's that? Yeah, sounds like he's making an awful big deal about the fact he wasn't taking any money. Anybody? He's bragging over the fact that he has the right to do it, but he's not doing it. He's foregoing it. But he says, I'd rather die than for anybody to take that away from me. No, you know, as we move into the next verses, I think we'll understand it a little bit better. But anyway, I've got to close because I'm out of time. Yeah, Walter.
I think this passage you're talking about, where the Lord commanded, my reference Bible here says it goes to Matthew 10:10, and I think it really does make sense here. Well, first of all, the first commission, he sends him out, providing either gold or silver, or your belt, or a bag for your journey, or tunic, or scandal for status, or a worker is worthy of his food.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he quotes that again in Timothy when he's talking to Timothy. But keep in mind, Paul did forego support while he was establishing the church. Okay? But after a church was established and was mature, he didn't have any qualms about taking support, as we see with the Church of Philippi and other places. Somebody else's hand just shot up.
That was me. I just wanted to say, he's more or less telling these people that I'm not doing this for the money.
Right.
Yeah. A job. I'm not doing this as a means of support. I'm doing it because I'm compelled to do so. And
he doesn't want to hinder the gospel in any way.
Right.
Yeah. And remember, he at the beginning of the chapter, he's defending his apostleship. And I think he's defending it by saying, look, here's what Christ has commanded, and I'm going way beyond even what Christ has commanded, even more so than any of the other apostles are. Mm-hmm. All right. So in essence, he's defending his integrity. Okay? All right, but he makes the point, though, here in verse 15, that it is a right, and his example isn't necessarily to be followed by everyone else. Yes, Linda?
Just, I don't know where you're going with the rest of the chapter, but it seems like you could also have Abraham in line, because Abraham, even though the king brought all his tenth to Abraham, he said, no, it wasn't that example.
I don't know what you're referring to, but why don't you look it up, and next week we'll talk about it.
All right.
Okay? But Abraham is the first one who tithed, by the way, long before the law was established. And somebody else tithed. Does anybody know who it was before the law was established? Somebody else did. The Bible says so. Who? No. Yeah. Who said Jacob? Good. Good. Yeah, we'll look at those two. All right.
King of Sodom.
Yeah, you're right. It's in the same passage, though, that of Abraham that you're talking about.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
A lot of Paul teaching, were the people still wondering if he was what he was before? Now he's out telling us all this good stuff. Is he bringing some of this kind of people?
He did, but not in this particular church.
He
was confronted by those who didn't believe he was really converted, those who thought he was an imposter, was preaching a false message. I mean, he had a lot of problems with people coming behind him and undermining his ministry. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, I'm glad he did. You know why? Because in order to defend his message and his lifestyle, he really wrote a lot of material that clarifies these things for us and puts them down in very crystal clear language so that we don't misunderstand. And anytime there's these kinds of conflicts in the early church and they wrote about it, it's for our benefit. It really is. Just like the Jews, you know, in the Old Testament when they had all the problems they had and God judged them and all that, Paul says that was all written down for our learning. All right, well, the same with the problems in the early church. Okay, all right, we got to close because we're 4 minutes over time. Walter, dismiss us, please.
Father, we thank you.